Hello again, and welcome to Lecture 34 in this American History Program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today is our last lecture of new material leading up to Test 2. So you already have the class notes pertaining to this content, but we're going to have a discussion extending one of the crucial themes that we can possibly encounter in all of history today pertaining to this breakup of Christianity into multiple warring sects and the outcome of that for history, which is very significant for all of us living here today. So that is going to be our main objective for today. But I wanted to see I wanted to have a discussion first about the four top anchor facts, and to see if there were any that really showed up more in common than any of the others. And I wanted to have students kind of present their case if they are willing, in order to kind of continue our discussion here of the so what of the anchor facts. So what I'd like everybody to do is to quickly chat the four anchor facts that they used in their version of the story. So just as a list, chat, type the four anchor facts that you used in your, don't write them out, write the dates. 4 BC, 1776, 9/11, something like that. Okay? All in one quick list. I'll give you an example of one that you might do. For instance, if I made my list, it would look like this. Now, don't type them all separately. Otherwise, the chat is going to be too messed up. Okay? So I would say I would do the following. This would be my list. There. One chat, four facts. Okay, so what about you guys? What would be your four facts? Okay, interesting. Ben's got three of the same and one different. Very interesting. Timothy's got two of the same and two different. Very interesting. Okay, who else? Keen has got, oh, they're out of order, but three of the same and one different. Declan's got only one the same. Okay, and Sophie's got, all right, very interesting. Sophie, yours are out of order. It would have been better to put them in the, well, I mean, never mind. That's not fair to say. You can write them in a different order, and that's actually quite interesting to write them that way. So maybe that's in the order of importance. So one thing that I'm seeing a lot is 1776. There are very, very few and that do not include 1776. And I've got to say, that is one that you need to have. So why is 1776 the top anchor fact? I mean, number one, there's absolutely no option about that one. So in the top four, I'm going to say that there are two that are non-optional and two that are optional. In other words, I'm willing to hear arguments about, okay, this is more important than that. And to some extent, there might be a kind of personal choice to say, this matters to me more than that, or, you know, right? But basically, there are two that are absolutely non-optional. So in 1776 is the first. Because, Keen, why is that?
Well, it's the rebirth of freedom for human beings, because we've been menacing and armoring it for almost 5,000 years, and then all of a sudden, freedom is reborn, and we don't, not everybody is just following the Menes and Armor monarchy, bath people's head in approach, and that means a lot for the world, because freedom is the best form of government.
Yes, I agree with you in the abstract, but what I would say is, beyond the value of it, okay, the value of it is absolutely true, so let's come back to that. But just in terms of the importance of it, we live in an America-centric world. So, how do you decide which of the anchor facts in history are the most important? You have to look at the world around you and identify it and realize and rank, what do these things have to do with my world? So you're right, Keen, that we live in a world that has this idea of freedom in it that was reborn thanks to the Founding Fathers. That's true, but the only way that that matters, and this is how we decide, not by what we like and what is most valuable, even though that factors, but rather what is most important. That's the standard. The so what question is the question that governs any such ranking. And the so what, there's nothing that can replace 1776. The world is an America-centric world. There's never been a country more powerful. There has never been a country more economically preeminent. There's never been a country more culturally influential in the entire history of mankind. Can't find it. And never mind, can't find it at any other time. Right now. Right now. Okay, so really, on this essay, if you're trying to describe, it's not an essay, but it's a paragraph, right? If you're trying to describe the world, and you don't have a fact that says the United States is in it, well, you have missed the essence. That is the most defining trait of modern life, is America-centrism. So that's 1776 is non-optional in the top four. And then, I would say after that, that what else features as an amazingly distinctive part of modern life? And that our lives could not be what it is without that. We are right now using a global information network. We could not have history at our house without it. The entire global economy could not function without it. Our way of life, with all of the things that are in it, would not exist without a certain thing. It's a broad and complex thing, but it's a feature of modern life that never existed for thousands of years, and then it happened. And so what is that other feature of modern life that is unique? It's about today. It's about us here now and no other time. And where does it come from? Timothy?
I think you're talking about Christopher Columbus discovers America.
Well, in relation to what?
In relation to,
what does that produce?
Well, I'm not 100% sure what you mean by that, but I believe you mean, Christopher Columbus globalized
the... Yeah, that's right. In relation to globalization. That is our modern time. Our modern life is a globalized way of life. Absolutely. Where Ebola goes from Africa to America on airplanes. In where iPads are invented in California but made in China. And where coconut water in your pantry comes from Thailand. And so on. right? And where we assemble in a History at Our House class that uses a global information network. So, yeah, that's our life, our times. So, absolutely, the two most important milestones, the two most important anchor facts of American history, bar none, are 1492 and 1776. Then you have to decide from there, okay, in describing this world of ours, well, connected to what other things? What other things from the past give us the most productive perspective on what America is like and so on? That, after that, becomes optional. You might feel that recent events matter more. So you might feel very acutely that America's conflict with the Islamic Middle East is a really defining feature of how you experience life now. And that could be for a variety of reasons, and that would be fine. You might feel, in a different regard, that Christianity is a really crucial feature of your personal life and of American culture, and therefore you want to put the emphasis there. And maybe, you know, there are going to be different ways of putting that. Usually I would go with, if I'm going to choose, I would go with something that's more fundamental. In other words, something earlier that explains things that come later. So I would be personally more inclined to choose the birth of Jesus over 9/11, in the sense that in modern times we have religious conflicts. Well, where do they come from? Well, you have to trace back to the antiquity of religion and the pervasiveness of it in cultures of the world and so on. We're going to talk about that today. And the uniqueness of America in that regard, which is going to be a big part of our class today. So I would be inclined to go with the birth of Jesus, but then at the same time, that ancient world is just no longer with us. And the conduit that transmits all of antiquity to us is Europe. And therefore, everything that came before, we don't know it, we don't encounter it, and it doesn't have an impact on us unless it goes through Europe somehow. So to me, that's the next one. So those are my four. 4 BC, 476, right? And then Columbus and America. But you can make the case, so don't get me wrong here. You can make the case that every single one of these deserves some major attention. So I'm not going to say that you're wrong if you chose another one. And certainly, in terms of the context for understanding where we're at, going all the way back to Manet's Narmer, you could definitely argue that. And you could also argue you don't get a rebirth of freedom unless you have freedom in the first place. So there's got to be a birth before a rebirth. So you could argue for democracy and republic in ancient times and so on, right? So there's certainly plenty of arguments to be made. You can't. American history, just nothing. Nothing is of any meaning or significance unless it includes 1492 and 1776. So those are the two non-optional ones, as far as the top four are concerned. And then after that, you can branch off. All right, so hopefully that's kind of a revealing way. And remember, the standard is this. The standard of selectivity is this. What does it tell me about the world I live in? What are those prominent features of the world that we live in? And how do we explain them? What do we link our understanding back to? What do we anchor our awareness to as we try to understand that world, historically speaking? Okay? So it's always past connected to present, grounded in what we see around us. Okay? Bria, go ahead. Well, no, I don't want to just have people listing off or anything like that, So, I mean, you get the idea here, and so everybody's had a chance to chat theirs, and that's fine. And so, think about the standard. That's the whole point of this here was simply to reiterate kind of, what is the standard? How do you choose? The standard is the present. So, for what it's worth, This is something that I'm developing as kind of a theoretical perspective on history. And I call it present centrism. So this is, I think, a really important philosophical topic in history. You've heard of things like, well, I've used the term America-centrism, and people use the term Eurocentric sometimes to describe certain things, and so on and so forth. My perspective on history is present-centric. So that means that the way to study the past is to start in the present and study the past and come back to the present. So that is present-centric. Okay. All right, so here we go now back to our shaping of the new world. So we left off, and the last time we were looking very closely at a certain principle that is very representative of European civilization. And that principle was cuius regio, eius religio. Now, what we are studying that for present-centrically is this. This is why we should care about cuius regio, eius religio. Because this document defines the American departure from that eternal notion which otherwise human beings would be stuck with. This is powerful stuff. So cuius regio, eius religio says what? What is the principle? Alexander?
The ruler chooses the
religion.
Decides what the religion is for all of the people under his rule.
There you go. Okay. So now, what is the American concept? It's right here in the Bill of Rights. Now, unfortunately, we can't read this particular version. So let's go to the transcript. And the transcript says, here we are, the Bill of Rights, Amendment 1. The very first thing that the Founding Fathers wanted to put in the Bill of Rights, and they couldn't put a higher priority on it. Number one. Somebody please read the American concept. Keen.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging...
Okay, stop there. We'll just focus on that because this is the freedom of religion part. Okay, so yeah, it's connected in their minds to other things, right? But here is number one, before the semicolon. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the exercise thereof. So, what does that mean? As opposed to, the ruler chooses the religion, how would you articulate this American conception of rulers and religions? Timothy.
The individual chooses their own religion.
All right, not bad. But I like that, Timothy, but I want a formulation that includes the word ruler and religion so that we can kind of do a little twist on the traditional concept. And what would be a formulation that includes the word ruler and religion? Bria, can you think of one?
There is no ruling the religion in our country. There is.
All right. Now, what happened to your sound? This happened to me earlier. Hold on a sec. Try it again. Okay. This has happened to me today, and I'm having a little issue. Juliet, go ahead, please.
The ruler will not choose the religion of the people.
Yeah, I think I'm accidentally muting people in ways that I cannot affect. It seems like we lost Bria or something. So All right, so you guys are both on the right track. Alexander, what's your formulation?
Ruler chooses his own religion.
No. No. Breyes was the best, but I think I have an even more essentialized formulation. Okay? So my formulation is no rulers in religion. No rulers in religion. Okay, so the Bill of Rights is mostly a set of statements that says, no, you may not, you will not, the government will not, we will not have this, no political power here. Okay, so no rulers in religion. You cannot have people making laws about religion. No rulers in religion. No prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So you're right, Timothy, that the individual gets to choose. But that is, and that's the premise of individual rights that the founders had. But here, in terms of the edict that they're applying in the Bill of Rights to cage the government, what they are saying is no rulers in religion. That's the American concept. And it's amazing because you cannot find this anywhere else. It's a stunning, brilliant innovation that is one of the most crucial things that the founding fathers bequeathed to humanity. To say this, to announce this in a world that had no conception of this whatsoever. No rulers in religion. And the founding fathers were really eager to understand this and apply this principle because they studied history. They looked everywhere in history. And so here's a quote from Thomas Jefferson. He says, quote, in every country, note the word every, and in every age, again, the word every, the priest has been hostile to liberty. He is always in alliance with the despot, the ruler, abetting his abuses in return for protection to his own. History furnishes no example of a priest-ridden people maintaining a free civil government. Wow, those are really strong words. And James Madison, who is the architect of the Constitution, here's his version of it. Quote, every new and successful example. So now, that what they're saying, they're having a conversation, in effect, about the value of freedom. And now Madison is saying, well, here's what we're going to do. Every new and successful example, therefore, of a perfect separation between the ecclesiastical and civil matters is of importance. Every new example will succeed in showing that religion and government will both exist in greater purity the less they are mixed. So this is powerful American thinking on a question which human beings had profoundly failed to come up with the right answer for thousands of years. So not only do we have rulers for thousands of years, right? Here, we'll go back to our... Not only do we have Manes Narmer back here in 3000 BC, but what do we have to go along with it? Here we go. Let's start here, back in ancient Egypt. What's going on here? Here we've got, I'll show you where he is if you can't spot him. Here we've got the Pharaoh with the umbrella. Right, he's always getting taken care of. And over here, what do we have? Right, and what's this for? What is this? This is ancient Cuius Regio, right? Who are the slaves, Bria?
The slaves are Hebrews that most likely they're Hebrews.
Yes.
And they're building a church off something.
Yeah, some kind of... Yeah, they're building some kind of religious temple for the Egyptian pharaohs, right? Or monuments, or pyramids, or whatever it is, right? This is cuius regio. Menes Narmer believed in that. Menes Narmer was a pharaoh. And that means that he and people like him promoted the view that they were gods among the people, and that they communed with the supernatural forces that regulated Egyptian life, and therefore everybody should follow them. And if you were of a different tribe and have a different religion, then you are enslaved. Cuius regio, eius religio. And when we get to European society, same deal. Here we have the Battle of Tolbiac, one of the battles that begins European history. Some of you will remember it from European history. What's going on here? With Clovis as the leader of the Franks. My veterans have got to know this. What's Clovis doing, Timothy?
Clovis is praying to God and sort of bargaining with him to say, I don't think he was Christian at the time. I'm not sure. I think he was of another religion, but he was praying to the Christian God, I think, that if he won the battle, he would become, I think it was a Christian Catholic. I'm not sure.
Yeah, he would become a Catholic Christian, right? It was the Battle of Tolbiac that basically made Europe Christian. Clovis is swearing to the Christian God, who's just symbolically illustrated up here in fanciful form, right? But so he's saying, I will follow you. If my tribe can slaughter this tribe, then you will be my God. If my tribe, my God, that is the motto of early European history. My tribe, my God, your tribe, your God, and therefore, this is what we do to each other. Right? So this is, right here in the top left corner, Charles Martel, for those of you who will remember that from European history. Fighting the Muslims on behalf of Christianity, right? My tribe, my God, your tribe, your God, and therefore, we are enemies. So, in the European mind, there's no way to separate these things. In the European mind, there's no way to separate, at least of this time and up to modern times, there's no way to separate my tribe, my God. Those go together. They're inevitably connected. Every tribe in all of these migrations that we studied from the very beginning had a certain religious belief and fought each other over it and slaughtered each other for that ever since, and following the example of every such people throughout history. So, cuius regio, eius religio is a universal principle until such time as America. And so this is really an amazing thing that we are studying this year. One of the most amazing things that, one of these most amazing things that the Founding Fathers bequeathed to history was this concept of severing this link that was completely assumed by human beings. They had absolutely no notion of not living any other way. It was completely assumed, my tribe, my God. And therefore, you're different, I kill you. People had no way to get past that. Too much of their lives was defined by this. And there were no examples. Remember Thomas Jefferson's quote, no examples of anybody thinking any other way. Now this is, you know, another good exercise in historical empathy. Why are the Christians of the Middle Ages here? Why are they going to slaughter each other by the tens of millions? And this is going to be one of the most devastating periods in the history of Western civilization. And it's not even going to be Christians fighting Muslims or pagans or whatever else. is going to be millions of Christians killing each other over slightly different interpretations of what's in the Bible. How can that be? In order to understand something like that, we have to have historical empathy, which we were talking about yesterday. And that means we have to be able to put ourselves in their shoes. If you went back and you had a conversation, magically could have a conversation with somebody from the past, and you said to them, why don't you guys try religious freedom? Why don't you guys try not linking these things? What would happen? What would be the response? This is a good test of your historical empathy. What would be the response? See if you can come up with an answer here. Take a minute, because I don't want to just leap to somebody else's answer. This is a test of your historical empathy. Are you in a position to be empathetic here? If all of history was governed by the same principle, and you come back and you suggest to somebody a complete departure from that, what's going to be their response? All right, let's see if you guys can figure this one out. Timothy.
Okay, I might be wrong here, but I think one thing they would say is that that the problem with allowing religious freedom, at least at this time, when religion was at its, like, pretty much everyone believed in a religion back then. So if you allowed religious freedom, then everyone could believe in what they wanted. But let's say...
Okay, stop. I'm going to stop you because I know you're struggling, and it's a really good thought, Timothy, but it's definitely not correct. So, no, that's not what they're going to say. Bria?
I'm just
going to
say you're crazy. This is not happening. They're just going to say that's not going to work.
Because it's not going to work? No, they're not going to say that. So both Bria and Timothy have a variation on the same thing, which is it's not practical, it's not going to work. Okay, now there's going to be something much more fundamental than that. Much more fundamental than it won't work. Keen?
I'm not sure about this one either, but I think they might say, this is impossible. You're saying, are you an enemy to my religion?
You're on the right track. You're on the right track. So let's assume here, yeah, because I might even have to change the situation. Let's assume it's somebody who's willing to listen, right? Somebody who's even capable of entertaining the thought, but which is very difficult to imagine in and of itself. But let's imagine somebody whose brain is on and who isn't completely closed off to new ideas, which you're probably not going to find many of. But anyway, what's going to happen there is, this is what's going to happen. They're going to say, what are you talking about? They're going to say, I have no idea what you're saying. What are you talking about? They would literally not understand what the reference is that you're trying to make. They would be completely confused by you. They would say, religious freedom. Now, what is that? They would have no clue how to interpret that statement. Because first of all, they don't even know what freedom is. So never mind religious freedom. They would be completely incapable of understanding what you are saying to them. So can you imagine? I mean, this is what historical empathy is. And in a sense, in some cases, nowadays, even cultural empathy. There are people like that today. Right? If you... And this is something that I think still people are really failing to grasp about the world out there. It's a dangerous place. There are people out there that have no concept whatsoever of freedom. Never mind religious freedom. and to this day. So you say those words, and it means less than nothing to them. In fact, what it means is you are some kind of foreign barbarian and a threat. Because whatever it is that you're saying, which they don't understand, it's obviously different than what they believe. And therefore, you're an enemy. So, yeah, unfortunately, to have historical empathy and to look back on wars of religion in history, we have to understand how people lived and what thought they could possibly have had. And it's very difficult to do because so many things we take for granted because of certain geniuses that had the first thoughts and took the first steps down untraveled roads. It's amazing. And this is part of the wonder of history. If you can get to this point where you see it, part of the wonder of history is to look at the founding fathers in awe. These people are incredible. There's nothing like them in all of history, which is why the United States is what it is, more than any other reason. 1776 is the top date in history. The founding of the United States is absolutely far and away the most significant event, single event in history. Because they're departing from this, from so much of what is absolutely taken for granted by human beings. They're saying things that they know the people of Europe just cannot wrap their heads around. Period. I mean, they just literally cannot entertain those thoughts. And America, to most of the world, remains a mystery. It remains a complete puzzle. How did this country become this great thing? How did it become so preeminent? How come it's not fair? I mean, people look at it and it's a complete mystery because they don't understand history. They're unable to see this revolution in thinking. Sometimes embodied in just a few short words, but it is the most revolutionary document that human beings have ever produced. Because it rejects all of the mistakes from the past in so many ways. Not all of them. That's the tragedy. What part of the tragedy of American history is that the founders could only do so much. And it's another one of those cases where people look back and they say, why didn't the people of the past do this or that or do more than they did? And I just shake my head. And I think to myself, you want the founding fathers to have done more than this? Are you crazy? Because you have to be. You have to be crazy to think that the founding fathers should have done more. It's unbelievable what they accomplished. It's unbelievable what the United States has been and continues to be in history. It is uniquely amazing. So you've got to get your mind wrapped around this and see it. The 1776 is there's nothing like it, and then follow on events like the Bill of Rights is later on. But it's just shocking. Cuius regio, eius religio, everybody accepts that. Everybody, everywhere, in all places, in all times. If you want the pharaohs of ancient Egypt, if you want the priests and kings of Mesopotamia, if you want the Aztec emperors cutting out the hearts of young ladies at the top of pyramids, and so on, you can look anywhere you want and you will find it. And then, America. And the whole thing is repudiated. It's unbelievable. It's really, then this is what history can help us understand. How did this happen? How could it be? What does it take to do this? And how do we get to this life and how wonderful certain things are? And how do we treasure those things properly and defend them? Keep these values because they're not normal. Don't for a second fall into the trap of believing that you will have these things just because they're there. They're there through blood, sweat, and tears. And they have to be kept by the same means. So anyway, I've gone on and on here. I went on somewhat of a rant on the amazingness of the freedom of religion in America, because it doesn't get better or more important than that as a value and as a present-centric priority for studying in history. How do we get here? It's not going to be through the birth of Lutheranism, where the lords who are Lutheran say, cuius regio eius religio. It's not going to be through the birth of Anglicanism, which, well, we don't have time for today, but it's in your notes, and it only in outlines, right? It's not going to be because a king, Henry VIII, says, I'm going to have my religion for my country. That's just cuius regio all over again. If you're English, guess what? You don't get to have your own religion either. You're going to be Anglican or else. Or else what's going to happen? You see that, and do you remember, does anybody know who, did you see the movie Elizabeth? You guys are still a little bit young maybe to have seen that. But I recommend it for kind of knowing a little bit, kind of getting a good sense. Because the movie Elizabeth starts with a very upsetting scene, with a very jarring scene during the reign of her sister, Mary, who is known in history as Bloody Mary. And what's happening in the very, very first scene, I hate to spoil it for you, but what's happening in the very first scene is Catholics, Anglicans are being killed because Mary was Catholic. And so Englishmen are going to kill each other. Why? Cuius regio, eius religio. You're not allowed to have your own choice of religion. Because in the European mind, that's not possible. A choice in religion means undisconnectable from your tribal allegiance, your national allegiance, and therefore, you'll be an enemy. There's no way to think of it. No other way to think of it. So Henry VIII in England, he's going to make Anglicanism. He's got his own disagreement with the Pope. And then what? And then John Calvin comes along, and he's got his own disagreement with both the Pope and with Luther. We're almost done, Bria. So, what's going to happen? How is Calvinism going to survive in this world that John Calvin initiates Calvinism? How does it survive? There's only one way. Bria? Whoa, I can't hear you at all. No, way, way louder, way closer to the mic. I don't know what's happening.
Can you hear me now?
Barely.
How about now?
Yes, go ahead. All right, by getting believers, no, not enough. What do you have to have a religio? That was a big hint. What do you have to have a religio? Keen?
A regio.
A regio! Exactly! So the only way that you're going to have a religion is if there's a state, if there's a government that's going to back you up, which means an army, which means people that will kill to defend your faith. So John Calvin gets his start in Geneva. It's a city-state in Switzerland. So now he's got a government, and everybody's going to back him up there. And then Calvinism spreads into France, and every regional lord that makes the conversion now has his supporters who are going to fight on behalf of this new belief. And this belief spreads to Netherlands as well, which is a little corner of the Holy Roman Empire that wants to be independent. So now you got to have enough people to fight for that different belief. Right. So this is the era of religious wars that we enter into just as America is being, for the first time, settled permanently by Europeans. So not very fortuitous circumstances, right? Because basically the Europeans are slaughtering each other over religion. So what's going to happen when American history gets started? These people now, the next phase of our story has to do with colonizers or colonists. The process of creating colonies, right? And what are we going to see? We're going to see Anglicans in America because the English are coming. We're going to see Catholics in America because the French are coming. We're going to see Calvinists in America because the Pilgrims are coming. We're going to see people of all different religious beliefs coming to the Americas, and therefore, what? What's this history of ours going to look like? Well, it's going to look like Europe, which is not a very good sign, right? It's going to involve regios and religios. And people trying to sort out, okay, how do we not follow the past in the wrong way? How do we not make America into just a copy of Europe? Because if that's the case, then we're not making any progress here. We're not going to live any better than Europeans. We're going to end up doing all the same mistakes. The question then is, how do you fix it? How do you get to the point where you understand this is just wrong and let's find a different way of organizing a society? It's not going to be easy because a lot of the Englishmen and Europeans who came to America were still stuck in the cuius regio, eius religio mindset. And it was going to take some really special people to start breaking free of that. And helping and doing some of that original thinking that's required to get to then this ingenious concept. No rulers in religion. How do we bridge that? How do we go from one to the other? How does this new world with the wonder of freedom of religion in it, how do we get there? That should be a pretty good teaser for more of our story coming up here after Thanksgiving. All right, well, that's it. Read up on your class notes. There's a little bit more detail on Henry VIII and his separation of England with his argument with the Pope. And then you've got Calvin with his argument with the Pope and then his argument with Luther. So therefore, he's going to have his own religion and he's got to have his own regios and otherwise it won't survive. And pretty soon, people are starting to come to America. That'll be the next chapter. All right. Good. Well, go enjoy your freedom. And study. Make you do your test prep. Freely, of course. And tomorrow's history through art. And then on Thursday, we'll see what your answers are to the test prep questions. Good luck with it. Bye for now.
Bye.